Welcome to the 125 Years and Counting podcast. We're here to discuss all things finance, helping to keep you up to date with everything accounting, financial planning, and achieving financial success.
Our Vanguard investment specialist. She's going to take you through a bit about what's been happening in the markets at the moment, how this compares to history, and what this means for your financial plan. So as I mentioned, encourage questions either throughout the session or at the end as well. So I might just pass over to Libby to kick us off.
Thanks, Alexi. And happy to keep this interactive. I know that most of you have put yourselves on mute, but if there's any particular burning questions that you want me to cover off on, I'm happy to cover off because I'm mindful this is your time and I want to make this relevant for you. So I guess if we look at the start of the year, it's certainly been a challenging start to the year for investors. And if we look at, you know, some of the major asset classes that we consider in this environment, REITs, US equities, I guess, since this chart was prepared by our economics team, has had a little bit more of a dip down. Aussie equities has held up relatively well, given that we do have exposure to commodities. That's been one thing that has helped to stand us in reasonably good stead. And I guess the other part of the market that has probably been capturing a little bit of attention is the bond market, where we've seen some of the biggest drawdowns in that sector, which is not typically a sector that we see big drawdowns in, but it has been a sector where we have seen some drawdowns or some historic drawdowns so far this year. If we step through to the, I guess, just providing some context for the what's been hitting the news wires in the last little while, the bear market that's been capturing some of the news attention in the last week, you can see this is not an unusual phenomenon for markets. You know, there's been several bear markets. This chart here shows the US stock market index, the S&P 500, which is actually the one that fell into bear market territory last week. The Australian market is not at that point. Aussie REITs market is, but yeah. And I guess, yeah, just drawing on that fact that point that since 1980, there have been 9 bear markets, and bear markets are defined of declines of 20% or more lasting a couple of months. But if we look at it, over the long term, you know, this is a feature of the investment markets. One of the discussion points that we've had a bit of a look at as well is just people often think about whether they can time, you know, getting in and out of the markets at when there's volatility. So our economics team went back and did some analysis of the 20 best trading days and the 20 worst trading days for the 1980 period through to 2020. And you can see that often the best trading days and the worst trading days happen close together. So it's very hard to predict when you're going to be capturing one and missing out on the other. And I guess probably the last week or so has been a little bit of an example of that. We obviously saw the US market tip into bear market territory last week, but then following their long weekend over there, it's rebounded again overnight. So, you know, there's been heightened volatility certainly coming through in that market. And I guess the other thing is that from a longer term perspective, not only is timing those entry and exit points to perfection pretty difficult to do. Also over a 1 year perspective, it's pretty difficult to pick those winners from year to year. And this is a chart which shows different asset classes. So Aussie shares, international shares, US shares, Aussie bonds, listed property, international property and international bonds for a period of 1992 through to 2021. Obviously, we'll be updating some of these charts will be updated and come out in August, so they'll be able to view them on our website. But you can see it's a pretty random pattern from year to year. I mean, sometimes the winner 1 year is a loser the next year. So there's a little bit of a pattern there, but it's very difficult to predict the order of those asset classes over time, which is why when we're looking at building portfolios, we take a very diversified approach in terms of putting together portfolios. So we have a mix of shares, which are typically more volatile. And if we look at and our expected outlook from different asset classes, you can see that our expected spectrum of returns that you might expect from Aussie equities over a 10-year period is much wider than you'd expect from bonds. And also, I guess the reason we have bonds in a portfolio is a little bit like an insurance policy, that they tend to zig when other asset classes are zagging. Over the short term, sometimes that relationship doesn't hold as true, but typically over the longer term, that is a relationship that holds true, that you have, one asset class is sort of doing really well when another asset class is sort of being a ballast in the portfolio. And that's something that we saw during the COVID period. We saw bonds certainly serve that purpose of holding as ballast in a portfolio and help to mitigate some of the drawdown risks that we saw come through that COVID volatility in 2020. So I might just move on to the fixed income markets and what's been going on in price movements there. So I guess what we've seen happening there is that the Federal Reserve and the RBA in Australia have shifted to very aggressively being combating inflation. And if we look back at inflation over a century and over a 75-year period for the Australian data, we haven't really had an inflationary period, and there's probably people on this call who do remember an inflationary period in the 1970s and 1980s. But I guess we haven't had an inflationary period for some time, and part of that has been due to the central banks having a price stability target as part of their objectives. And the other part of their objectives is to maintain stability or maintain full employment in their economies as well. Clearly, those two things sort of work at odds with each other, and I guess what the central banks are navigating at the moment is a very short runway for a soft landing of the economy. And I think increasingly the risk is probably pivoting to that the central banks, both here and overseas, particularly in the US, are slamming on the brakes to try and head off inflation. And I've had the question before about why they would be looking to raise interest rates at the same time people are feeling pain on the inflation side. I guess from a central banker's point of view, the things that they have in their toolkit are monetary policy, and with monetary policy, what they're trying to do is slow down the economy to a point where there's less demand for goods and services, and that should sort of mitigate some of those supply demand imbalances that we've seen, particularly emerging from the pandemic, and bring those things back into check. So that's the instrument that they don't have a lot of things in their toolkit, but that's what they're trying to do, is slow down the economy enough so that inflation, which is being driven by strong demand and a lack of goods in some cases and a lack of supply of labour, they're trying to sort of soften that off a little bit. I guess the tricky thing is that often what happens is that central banks slam on the brakes so hard that economies tend to tip over into recession. And that's what we've seen starting to come priced into the fixed interest markets in the last week or so, that there is a pricing in of a recession. And some of you may have seen on the news that one of the yardsticks for that is just having a look at the steepness of this curve. So you can see this is basically a curve which shows the interest rates that you can get on a range of different bonds. And if you think of bonds as like an extended version of term deposits, these are like 10, 15, 20, 30-year term deposits essentially. So you can see that from where the cash rate is, and I might click over to Australia, from where the cash rate is, you can be very well, and you've probably seen this yourselves in your term deposit accounts, that the term deposit rates have gone up quite a lot. And so that's on the back of the interest rate expectations from the broader market feeding through into how those term deposits are priced. And so one of the yardsticks for what people are looking at when they're thinking about the what might happen with central banks is that there's been a lot of front loading of rate hikes. And I think we've seen, you know, central banks move from 25 basis point rate hikes to 50 basis points in Australia last week to 75 basis points in the US as well. So there's been a lot of bringing forward of those rate hike expectations. And I guess if we look at the picture over the over a 5, 10 and 15 year period, you know, what we're seeing coming through there is that they're probably expecting that there'll be a lot of rate hikes very, very soon, and that they will eventually have, they will have an impact on the economy quite quickly, and there won't be a need for rate hikes in 3, 5, 7, 10 years' time. And in fact, in the US, we're seeing that they've started to price in that there might be rate cuts that will be necessary. And I think there's even some talk that the Fed themselves are going that, well, they might need to cut rates as early as 2023, acknowledging that they're already on a path of hiking rates. So I guess that's one thing we've seen come through in the markets.
Libby, go on. Yeah, we might just pause there. That was a lot of kind of information to take in. So I just want to touch back, just might quickly recap on what Libby's touched on so far. So what you're saying, Libby, is essentially that volatility is normal. What we're seeing at the moment is part of a normal cycle. Secondly, it's hard to pick winners. So, you know, that's the importance of staying invested for the long term so you can take advantage of those. The third one being, you know, the importance of diversification. And I'm sure many of you are probably familiar with the diversified funds that you're probably using in your portfolios. And it's very hard to pick those asset class winners. So the importance of having those different asset classes within your portfolio. And then finally, as Libby just mentioned, just taking into consideration that those rate hikes are already priced into the market. And hopefully within the next 3 years or so, we don't see as many.
Yep. And another thing just to note, in the diversified funds with the fixed income exposure, I guess essentially how, and given that there has been a lot of questions around this, given the fall we've seen in bond prices, and that has flowed through to the conservative fund suite, because that has quite a lot of exposure to bonds in the conservative fund, around 70%. So I sort of liken it, again, coming back to that term deposit example of that maybe six or nine months ago. So what happens in those funds is it's a little bit like a basket of term deposits. We have cash flows coming in from maturities, and that cash is reinvested at today's rates. And so say, for instance, 6 months ago, you might have locked in $100,000 in a 2 year or a 3 year three year term, and that might have been earning maybe 30 basis points. And this is the central bank. This is the fixed income market. So I'm talking here, not necessarily term deposit rates, but the analysis is similar. So you might have been locking in that at around 30 basis points. Nowadays, you're probably looking at a rate upwards of 2.5% to 3% on that same security. So if you had locked that in 6 or 9 months ago, you'd probably be feeling a little bit disappointed that you'd locked in your term deposit at that low rate. But if you had something rolling off today, you'd be quite happy that the rates looking forward have improved quite a lot. And so that reinvestment effect is what we're seeing working its way through the bond part of the portfolio. And that's a slow path to recovery, because there's a lot of bonds in the portfolio, and that, you know, there's got varying maturities. So there's 5, 10, 15 year bonds in there that obviously will take some time to work their way through to being reinvestable today. But I guess the message is that those bonds are being reinvested today at a much higher rate, and that should improve the outlook going forward. And I think that's a slower path to recovery. What might happen, what might be more likely, given the last time we saw this sort of volatility in bond markets, was that to that point earlier where the central banks slammed on the brakes in terms of doing a lot of rate hikes very quickly, they might have to reverse course, and have to reverse course quite quickly in 12 or 18 months or 2 years' time. And that would feed through in terms of, you know, improving the capital price of those bonds over time very quickly as well. But I guess the key takeout is that for fixed income, most of the return that comes through from that is income. So actually, those high yields that we are seeing in the bond market, while they've caused some short term pain, do actually bring a long term benefit to the portfolio in the terms of higher rates that you're investing those cash flows at. And I might just sort of put that into context in terms of building portfolios. So if we have a look at the different asset class mixes that we have in the diversified funds, and we have exposure to Australian equities, global equities, both hedged and unhedged, and Australian fixed interest, global fixed interest and cash, but I've included listed property here for context because a lot of people do have exposure to listed property as well. And so you can see this shows, I guess, the range of different returns. This is data from early 2000s. And this is the 1 year returns that you might have expected, they have seen from Australian equities, global equities, and those different asset classes. So you can see that the equity as asset classes do tend to have a higher range of expected or range of returns that come through. This incorporates obviously the data. This data will be showing, the drawdowns that were experienced in the GFC. So some of those extreme numbers, and then the rebound from the GFC as well. So you can see that, I guess, on the left-hand side, that those asset classes do tend to have more volatility. And when you're blending those with what is typically a much less volatile asset class, so the bond fixed interest asset classes on the right-hand side, then, that's why when we're looking at constructing a conservative fund, for instance, we're going to be allocating more to bonds because they tend to be a less volatile asset class than equities. Having said that, if we look at that black line, which is where we're tracking now, you can see that in terms of where the fixed income assets are tracking, that's probably at the lowest point that we've seen for some time. Just said that does improve the forward-looking returns, but I guess that is why you're seeing some of those numbers come through on the conservative side of the portfolio as being towards the bottom end of what we'd be expecting from that type of asset. But it does set you up for improved returns going forward. And again, if we look at, when we're for the Vanguard funds, it's not unusual that you would expect that from year to year. Now, we adopt a strategic asset allocation approach. And what that means is that we pretty much have a set allocation to each of those asset classes. So, for instance, in the conservative fund, we might have 30% allocated to a mix of global equities and Australian equities, and we'll have 70% of the portfolio in those fixed interest and cash assets, those less volatile assets. Whereas in a growth portfolio, we'll have the reverse situation where we have 70% exposed to those equity assets asset classes, which do provide a higher risk but higher return over the longer term. And a lesser exposure to fixed income. And so because we don't tend to jump at shadows and, move our asset allocation around at all during those periods, we think that roughly having that blend does deliver a long-term outcome and means we're not caught out in any guessing games of which asset class will outperform and underperform from year to year. That does mean, over the short terms relative to some of our peers, that sometimes our numbers will sort of lag and sometimes they'll be ahead. But I think one of the other things to note in terms of how we're building portfolios is that we're taking a very low cost approach. And I guess when you think about markets, the things that you can control are the amount of risk that you're taking. And by that, I probably mean the amount of equity risk that you're taking in a portfolio. So you can mandate how much risk you're willing to take in that part of your portfolio. And the other thing you can, I guess, look to control is cost. And then as far as what the markets do day to day, the reality is that none of us have a functioning crystal ball. We wouldn't be here if we did. And so it's a little bit of a guessing game as to whether how the markets are going to respond in any given situation. So our approach is that having a mix of equities and bonds appropriate to your needs is the best course of action. And the other aspect is controlling costs. So when we're thinking about costs, we're thinking at that from several layers. All of the portfolios that the equity portfolios and bond portfolios that we run are pretty low turnover. So they're not, you know, buying and selling and burning brokerage costs by doing that. So we're not burning brokerage costs on the way through by swapping asset classes. We're not burning brokerage costs by switching in and out of different stocks underlying that. And that does have quite a powerful benefit over the long term. So if we look at those 7 and 10 year numbers relative to peers, I think you're probably all familiar with the benefits of compounding over time and compounding it from a return perspective. And that's something that I guess is captured in this chart here, you know, the benefits of staying invested in the market and reinvesting in the market over time does reap rewards. I guess you have a similar effect when you're keeping costs low, that you're not stripping out those costs over time. And so over a 7 and 10 year period, we've seen that, you know, that is a benefit that helps a low cost approach rise to the top. You're not chopping and changing, you're not burning those transaction costs on the way through, and you're delivering a very strong outcome over a 7 to 10 year period. So I guess that's when we're thinking about volatility in markets, we're taking a very long term approach. We think about it as a marathon and not a sprint. Obviously, we'd like to be all green all the time, but the reality is that our approach means that sometimes we're not going to be top of the pops, but we're comfortable that over a longer term that low cost approach and that approach of blending asset classes the way we do does deliver a strong outcome to you as the investor, and you end up with more money in your pocket and less money in the fund manager's pocket funding their yachts or their houses on Sydney Harbour. So that's probably most of the main points I was going to cover off on. Lexi, if you want to do a bit of a recap.
Yeah, perfect. Thanks, Libby. So just to recap on that kind of second half, you know, while bond markets are facing probably one of the worst quarters in 50 years, as Libby mentioned, you know, there is that reinvestment effect, which is the positive side of what's happening in the bond market. So we haven't seen yields this high in such a long time. And as she mentioned, you get that benefit of reinvesting those coupons year on year as well. And we could either, there's kind of two paths to recovery with bond markets, that reinvestment effect, or the market, you know, comes to the realization that they've overpriced and it bounces back as well. So just reinforcing, you know, short-term pain for long-term gain. And as you can see here, over the long term, you know, having a diversified portfolio that's low cost is always, you know, the best option in Vanguard's opinion. So think about what you can control with the cost and the risk that you're taking on as well. So hopefully that gave you a bit of a update on what's happening in the markets at the moment and give you a bit more of a perspective on, you know, the diversified funds and what we see going forward in terms of price rises and what's going to happen in the bond market especially. But are there any questions? And feel free to ask, you know, any broad level questions to Libby. She's been, you know, in the fixed income market for 20 plus years, so she's got a wealth of knowledge behind her.
One thing I forgot to mention was probably just on that aspect is that unlike the GFC, where obviously we saw, you know, volatility in markets as well, particularly with related to some fixed income funds, this is not about a loss of permanent loss of capital. This is really just the market recalibrating. So, yeah, like I was exposed to, well, in a previous life, I used to rate a lot of mortgage funds and there was quite a few investors, you know, who were exposed to those and lost capital. And this is not that situation. All the bonds we have in our portfolio are high quality government and corporate bonds that we fully expect to pay their 100 cents on the dollar back. So there's no credit risk per se. Graham, you have a question?
Yes, good morning. Look, perhaps like a lot of investors having reached retirement, I leave it to others to manage. And perhaps this is a question for Brent as well, but and I rarely look at I plot the overall balance of my portfolio monthly, but I don't really read much about it and I don't understand it. And we're across several asset classes, and Brent gives me a statement of advice every year, which I when I retired, looked at closely, but really haven't looked at in depth. And I think it's perhaps time that I start to get a better understanding. So the question is, where do I start? But I don't want to spend hours at my desk every day trying to follow and understand what's going. So just like a helicopter view, but more an understanding of the market and where my portfolio, well, I know where it is. I know the categories it's invested in. But is there a simple approach to this?
Yeah, I can sort of start. And I guess it's probably natural that people, well, there's probably two things that happen during periods of volatility. Some people watch it more when it's going up and like to see that the green's going up a little bit more every day. And other people are comfortable that their portfolio is what they're doing, what it's they expect it to, and probably really only focus on it when it's going down. But I think the takeout is that, you know, over time, markets do tend to trend upwards. And it's really, and I guess the benefit of having a diversified approach is that you don't have to worry about, you know, this stock or that stock, and there's no crypto in any of our funds, so you don't have to worry about that for a start. But I guess the benefit of having a diversified approach is that it's like not having all your eggs in one basket. Essentially, with the Vanguard diversified funds, you've got access to all the ASX 300 stocks that, you know, might get mentioned at barbecues. You've got access to all of those in your portfolio, so it's not this over that. It's like you've got all of it in there already. And similarly with the global stocks, so you're basically getting access to pretty much anything that's listed around the world in the diversified funds, and similarly on the bond side. So I guess a 101 for looking at markets, and Brent will probably have some suggestions as well. But and I get this question from my mum too, who's retired, who's going, my shares have gone down. I go, well, yours and everyone else's, mum. But, you know, but over the long term, I guess, you know, you've got to think about how your portfolio has delivered and over the long term. So I'd probably be less focused on, I know that you obviously need to know what's there from month to month, but I'd probably be trying to be less focused on what's gone on from month to month and just think about those long-term trends and not be generally, you know, some people might think of getting out of the market when it's going down, and generally that's the worst time to be thinking about getting out of the market, because a lot of contrarians are actually thinking about using that as an opportunity to get in. And I don't know, Brent, you might have something to add on that.
Yeah, Graham, we try and circulate the so Vanguard. So what I like about Vanguard is it's a consistent message that we're getting, and also as well, they do a quarterly asset allocation report. So I find it's a great snapshot of, like, yeah, and again, like the news at the moment, like they haven't said yesterday the market was up over 1%. They haven't said, they don't capture that thing. So you always hear the bad stuff, but the asset allocation report gives you a good little concise snapshot of what's happened in the past little bit, and then also a bit of a forecast as sort of what's sort of coming up. So I think for me, like, I know I'm reading stuff daily, but if that's the only thing you read, you probably don't need to read too much more, because it tends to cover off on the main themes, and the main things of maybe what's led to certain outcomes. And even, and this is a question I'd have for Libby, is Vanguard normally, I don't know, have a bit of a base case on where they think things are going to be, and then maybe have a worst case and a best case sort of outcome, because I read a breadth of information, and you got the doomsdays, you got the eternal optimists. I always tend to find that the Vanguard stuff is based on a lot more factual information. So I suppose I am curious around, I know, and people say recession, oh, you probably think back to maybe the 30s and what all that sort of meant in the 1930s when it was in a real recession. A technical recession is, I think, 2 negative quarters of GDP. So that just means the economy's gone backwards for a little bit. You've mentioned that. I like that terminology, a short runway for a soft landing. Like, yeah, is what's Vanguard's view on the recession?
I think the longer that we see inflation hang around, and the more aggressive we see, and it's, you know, the language you're hearing from the Federal Reserve in particular is more aggressive in terms of combating that inflation, and not quite doing whatever it takes, but largely sort of, you know, that's their main thing at the moment. They're really wanting to combat inflation, given that it's at a 40-year high, and so history tells us, and history doesn't always repeat, but it often rhymes. I guess, you know, history tells us that a lot of times during a rate hiking cycle, what happens is that we do end up in some sort of recession. And given that the whole reason that the Fed is hiking rates is to soften the economy a little bit, it's not surprising maybe that they soften the economy a bit too much. Because, I don't know, having done the economics subject when I was at university and played around with being a central banker in one of those subjects, it was really hard to manage the economy and just understand what was going on there. And to your point on the range of expectations, you know, we do spend quite a lot of time having a look at, you know, a range of potential outcomes that could occur. We don't just go, you know, we think this is where Aussie equity is going to be at the end of the year or at the end of 10 years, and we're going to position our portfolios accordingly. We go, well, we basically punch a whole lot of things into a queue, so 10,000 different scenarios that sort of feed into a possible range of outcomes that could happen from here, and that's where we come up with those sort of best worst case scenarios and of returns, and we're trying to blend portfolios to sort of take your account of all the possible things that could happen in the future in building portfolios, and using a lot of academic research to do that as well. So, sorry, you had another question.
And I suppose, Graham, like, I know the hardest thing for me at the moment as an advisor is probably talking to clients, and it's only just starting to come up is, I know, as I've explained to you and most of our clients who are in that retirement phase, is we operate with this bucket strategy, and we have the defensive bucket, and that's gone backwards, and that sort of defeats the purpose of what the defensive bucket is. And I suppose that for me is the really hard part at the moment. And back to Libby's slide before, like the we all knew that interest rates were going to go up at some point. It's just, I suppose, what a few of the things with the Russia-Ukraine situation on the back of COVID, it's not necessarily demand that's causing the issue. It's the supply chains, and that's really forced prices up. So
yeah,
the need to raise interest rates at this velocity has probably caught most people off guard. But in saying that, I remember probably 7 years ago when interest rates started coming down, everyone's like, oh, they can't stay this long forever. We're not going into bonds and that sort of thing. Well, they've been on the sidelines for 7 years. So
exactly.
It's very hard to get the timing right. It's crap at the moment because we've had clients and particularly have had some that have come out of into retirement and we've invested into bonds, and there's this big drawdown that's happened, which is, yeah, it's really tough for me as an advisor to explain that. It's tough, obviously, you to look at your portfolio and see that position as well. But again, we should have adequate cash reserves. Plus, as Libby said, the increased distributions that will come through to ride it out. And as Libby said, probably the main thing is different to the GFC is there's not as big a concern as companies not being able to repay those loans.
No. And again, if we go back to that 1994 scenario, which was, you know, similar-ish to what we're seeing, but not necessarily quite the same. If we look at 1994, which was that last horror year for bonds, we did see, you know, that drawdown in 1994, and then a really eye-wateringly good return from bonds. And I guess people have said, okay, well, that was when we had rates basically going from 6% to 10%. You know, could we see those type of returns? If we saw an exact repeat of what happened in 1995 and 96, could we see strong returns from bonds? And the answer is yes. And part of the reason for that is the structure of the market has changed a little bit since then. So probably the basket of bond portfolios that we're investing in is a little bit more sensitive to rate changes, notwithstanding that we might be starting at sort of 4% now in terms of that. If we scratch out those numbers and go basically sub 1% to 4%, which is what we've seen happen probably since late 2020, 2021 up till now, we've seen that this part of the portfolio, if we did see a reversal of, I think it was basically went back to around 8%, 7 or 8% from 10%, we could see returns from bonds in the teens, even though the actual yield on those bonds is sort of in the order of 2 or 3%. So, yeah, the dynamics have changed a little bit, but you know, if we did see this scenario, we could see quite a quick recovery from the bond part of the portfolio. But the slower path to recovery is that reinvestment effect, as I said, that you know every day we're reinvesting in bonds at high yields nowadays. So that's the good news story.
Libby, just on that, I have heard, like, you hear different people's, like, obviously that graph you had before, that line, as far as expectations on the yield curve and where interest rates go to, you see it at the moment, even as you said, with the term deposit analogy, some people are offering higher rates of term deposits than others. So it's still a bit of a guessing game with all of this. So if central banks, you know, jack up the rates, they get back in control of things and possibly, yeah, those rates could come down or maybe not need to go as high. And so, like, does Vanguard have a view on that?
I guess we're probably not too far from where the market is in terms of what we're expecting. We are, you know, expecting a number of rate hikes, both here and in the US. And I think, you know, we'd done some work pre-pandemic that was thinking neutral was around 3, terminal, which is where we might have to get to in terms of, you know, where we might have to hike to and then fall back to what looks like neutral, which is sort of not restrictive and not like it's the Goldilocks sort of rate. We're thinking that's around 3%. So, you know, given that we've got around the 4% on longer term bonds in both and not quite as high in the US, but in Australia, certainly, you know, we're probably thinking that might be where they end up. You know, picking the direction of policy rates, and have a confession that I used to be a fixed income manager in a previous life, so this was part of my job. Picking the direction of interest rates, and this is the markets, the orange, I guess, that mustardy lines are the market's expectation of what would happen with rates, and the green line is what the Federal Reserve actually did with rates. So you can see that the market spends a lot of time trying to guess what might be happening, what might happen to the direction of policy rates, and they're not always right. That even the best portfolio managers who do this for a living from an active perspective going, oh, we think it's gone enough, admit that they only get it right 55% of the time, which is a little bit more than a flip of the coin. So, our view is that, well, my view personally is that they've gone, given that I've been in and around these markets, is that they have gone a long way very quickly, and that now it's probably looking like an opportunity for opportunistic investors. But that's I don't know your personal situation, but that's just me looking at the bonds going, they have gone a long way in quite a short space of time.
And the other thing I read, I don't know how true this is or not, it's just a bit of commentary I picked up, was the level of, like, compared to, say, the 90s, where interest rates went up, the level of rate increase now, say, 0.5% increase now, has a much bigger effect than it did back then due to the overall debt load. Is that right? Or
I think I saw an article in the Financial Review a couple of weeks ago, which was sort of referencing that, especially with respect to mortgage holders in Australia. From the investment perspective, that now that is biting a little bit more than it did all those years ago, but also from a central banker's point of view, and the other thing they're wanting to do is probably soften the economy but not kill it off. So from Governor Lowe's point of view, he's probably thinking that Australian households are probably a lot more indebted than they used to be, notwithstanding that probably a lot of retirees aren't. But there's probably a lot of households that are, you know, feeling a pain quite quickly on any rate hikes. So that would be the other thing in the back of their mind in terms of feeding through rate hikes to the economy, especially given the sensitivity to construction and housing. I mean, yeah, we build stuff and we dig stuff up. That's a big part of our economy. So killing that off is obviously going to be front of mind for the RBA especially.
Thank you.
If you do have any follow-up questions after the session, feel free to email through Brett, and we can grab Libby's opinion on it as well. So don't hesitate to send through any questions.
Thanks very much, Lexi and Libby, and thanks everyone attending. We'll upload the audio to our podcast.